Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. Trafficking in women is a pressing issue in Eastern Europe, but as Talking History's Terry Clark and his guest this week explain, it is not unique to that part of the world, and it has a long history. Later, Peter De Tierney gives us his perspective on history of film education in America. But first, let's take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. A miracle of aviation was discovered on June 5, 1783. The French Montgolfier brothers, Joseph Michel and Jacques Étienne, conducted the first public demonstration of flight in an unmanned hot air balloon in a 10-minute flight over Annonay, France. Both men were interested in scientific experimentation, and their experiments paid off in 1782 with their discovery that heated air, when contained in a large, lightweight paper or fabric bag, could cause the balloon to rise into the air. In June 1783, they put their discovery to the test before the French public. By burning straw and wool under the opening of their balloon, the Montgolfier brothers were able to produce enough heated air to elevate the balloon to an altitude of 3,000 feet and to sustain flight for 10 minutes before the balloon landed more than a mile and a half from where it was launched. Excited about the dazzling success of their experiment, the brothers took their hot air balloon to Paris and to Versailles, where they repeated the experiment with an even larger balloon. They sent a sheep, rooster, and duck aloft for about 8 minutes over a distance of 2 miles. On November 21, 1783, the Montgolfiers sent two men aloft in the first successful manned balloon flight. It soared over Paris, traveling 5.5 miles in 25 minutes. In response, many proclaimed that man had mastered the air. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, Richard Nixon papers recently declassified by the National Archives reveal a president fraught with worry over what sort of gift to bring on the historic visit to Communist China in 1972. For months, Nixon, Henry Kissinger, and his aides agonized over suggestions that ranged from giving Chairman Mao a corporate jet to returning priceless works of Chinese art. Finally, Nixon and Kissinger settled on any gift that was American-made. Nixon arrived in China bearing 2 Alaskan musk oxen. In return, China gave the United States 2 giant pandas. A motion seeking a royal pardon for William Wallace, the Scottish hero, portrayed by Mel Gibson in the 1995 movie Braveheart, is making its way through the Scottish Parliament. Tory Representative Phil Galley seeks official recognition of Wallace as a patriot before the arrival of the 700th anniversary of Wallace's death in August 2005. His motion is an effort to erase the blemish of treason on Wallace's name and to potentially bolster Scotland's tourist industry. Betrayed after his defeat at the Battle of Falkirk and taken to London in chains, Wallace was accused and convicted of treason for resisting, often successfully, better-equipped invading English armies. Wallace was publicly executed in London in 1305. This is Talking History. The newly independent nations of Eastern Europe are struggling with illegal trafficking in women. It's an age-old problem, however, on which Terry Clark and his guest Martina Vandenberg shed some historical light.
The issue of trafficking in women has been highlighted in a series of international women's conferences. For many regions of the earth, it has become one of the most pressing social issues. The CIA estimates that as many as 40,000 to 50,000 women each year may become newly entrapped in some form of forced servitude in the United States alone. Most of these women arrive from Asia and Africa. The form that the servitude takes varies widely from prostitution to forced marriage to agricultural labor and often involves children. Here today to discuss the problem with us is Martina Vandenberg. Ms. Vandenberg is a graduate of Columbia Law School and a researcher for Human Rights Watch's Women's Rights Division. Welcome to our show, Ms. Vandenberg.
Thank you very much.
Let me start by asking you, just what exactly is trafficking in women? How is that defined?
Well, the idea of trafficking in women has been around for almost a century. The actual language was used in 1895, the very first time. But trafficking in persons, trafficking in women, has a very specific legal definition. And that definition comes from a trafficking protocol that is part of a convention against transnational organized crime that was just signed in December of last year. So under that definition, trafficking in persons means the recruitment, transportation, transfer, or harboring of receipt of persons by means of force or threat of force or coercion. Now, that's a very important part of the definition because it's important that some form of coercion or abduction or fraud or deception be present. And the entire time the trafficker has the intent of bringing the person to another country or another region with the purpose of putting them in forced labor, some form of exploitation. Now, that exploitation can be forced prostitution, but that exploitation can also be forced labor and other slavery-like conditions.
So it's really quite a definition that covers a quite broad set, then, of some form or set of forced servitude.
That's absolutely the case. And interestingly enough, the international law definition included in this protocol includes the removal of organs. So it's even broader than forced labor and servitude. It also includes forced removal of organs.
My goodness, that sounds rather heinous. I mean, what percentage... Do you have any idea what percentage of women might be in that category?
I think that's probably a tiny percentage. There's a lot of rumor and mongering about removal of organs, but frankly, I've never been able to document a single case.
Right.
So it's certainly rumored that this happens, and rumored enough that, in fact, they put it in the protocol.
You were saying that the term itself came into usage in 1895, and in fact, the problem has been around for some time. When did it first appear in terms of an international problem?
Well, the first time that it was really recognized as an international problem was at an international conference in Paris in 1895. And then women's organizations, many of them actually Jewish women's organizations, came forward in order to protest the trafficking of women for forced prostitution. At that 1895 conference, they decried trafficking of persons, but they were thinking specifically of trafficking of young girls and women into prostitution, particularly in Europe.
And so this was a conference in 1895.
That's correct.
But the concern was only for trafficking in Europe.
It was broader than that, but most of the women's organizations that actually raised this at the conference in Paris were women's organizations from European countries. And so, unfortunately, all of this was conceptualized as white slavery. And that was how they talked about it, white slavery. The idea that women of color, that women from Africa or women from Asia might also suffer from trafficking, I don't think really crossed their minds, or at least it didn't enter the paperwork. In 1904, there were 16 states that met officially in Paris, and they created an agreement against white slavery. And again, that was the language they used, white slavery. So the slavery of people from Africa and forced servitude and forced labor and forced prostitution of other women around the world, that really remained invisible.
When did the international community begin to transition to recognizing this slavery or trafficking in women in general as being applied to women of color as well?
Well, this has been a very, very long, long evolutionary process. In 1910, states got together again, and this time they did a convention, but again, on the suppression of the white slave trade. And it wasn't until 1921 that there was an international convention for the suppression of the traffic in women and children. And here, this one was important. First of all, they took off the label of white slavery, and secondly, they extended it to boys. So the name where it says women and children means women and children of both sexes. So, again, this is an evolution at beginning to acknowledge that all people, not just women, are trafficked, and that little boys can be trafficked and forced into labor and servitude as well.
So 1921, then, is a major turning point in terms of the evolution of our understanding of this problem.
It is in terms of understanding, but it isn't really in terms of legality. The real legal turning point came in 1949, when there was a UN convention for the suppression of traffic in persons and the execution of others. And the 1949 convention, under the auspices of the United Nations, marked a really important legal turning point for this.
And I'm not quite sure, but what was the legal turning point at that point?
Well, the legal turning point was that this was actually a convention that states could ratify, a much more formal process than had existed under the League of Nations prior to World War II. And so under the United Nations, again, there were committees that could review implementation of the convention. There was the General Assembly that did resolutions on trafficking. And from a legal perspective, this convention was, in a sense, more binding than the previous conventions. It's interesting, though, because at the end of the day, only 66 of all 160 UN member states ever ratified the convention. Many states decided not to ratify the convention for a variety of reasons. Some of them decided that they didn't like the fact that the convention forced them to actually outlaw prostitution. Some countries wanted to keep prostitution legal, and so they didn't ratify the convention.
And where did we go then in the evolution of this international regime since 1949?
Well, specific to trafficking, unfortunately, there was an enormous gap that took decades and decades. In the meantime, there were small steps with UN resolutions that helped the understanding of trafficking evolve farther, just away from the idea that all of this is all about prostitution, and more towards this is all about forced labor. But the real breakthrough on making trafficking a crime under international law and making trafficking an explicitly defined crime under international law didn't really come until the year 2000, when negotiations were completed on the Convention Against Transnational Organized Crime, and negotiations were completed on what were called the baby protocols. The Convention Against Transnational Organized Crime was called the Mother Convention, and then these were the little satellite protocols that hung on the bottom of that convention. One protocol was on trafficking, and one protocol was on smuggling. The protocol on trafficking has, the name is an enormous mouthful. It's the Protocol to Prevent, Suppress, and Punish Trafficking in Persons, Especially Women and Children, supplementing the United Nations Convention Against Transnational Organized Crime. Now, that entire mouthful, really all that means is that this new protocol gives us a definition, and the definition is enormously important because at this point the definition extends beyond forced prostitution. At this point, the definition extends into other forms of forced labor and slavery-like practices. In fact, all forms of forced labor. That's an enormous turning point legally because that means that people who are trafficked into agricultural servitude or trafficked into forced marriage or trafficked into domestic servitude have the same human rights as people who are trafficked into forced prostitution.
So we've started in 1895 then with a problem that was largely considered to be a problem among whites in the continent of Europe. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And then by 1921, we recognize this as including women of color, so now it becomes more global. But in 1949, we expand the categories. In 2000, we have this. We have our current understanding.
That's correct.
Yeah. And 2000 is, of course, as you're saying, is quite an evolutionary step forward.
The reason why these conventions and why these agreements come with so much difficulty is because they are based on consensus. And I participated in negotiations in Vienna when states argued back and forth for months, literally, about what the wording would be in this trafficking protocol. And the consensus takes an enormous amount of time because with these protocols, with these conventions, come responsibilities. States that sign on and states that ratify agree to provide certain services and agree to criminalize certain activities, which means changing their own laws in their domestic legislation. So the conventions and protocols come slowly, and it really is an evolutionary process. But happily, it's a process where non-governmental organizations can also participate to point out the flaws in these negotiations and point out the flaws in these conventions while they're still in the process of being negotiated.
The evolution is fascinating, but I'm wondering if apart from the evolution, do we have any historical analysis or understanding of where the problem really has been greater at different periods in time?
It's very difficult to say because one of the things that we find in trafficking generally is that statistics just cannot be relied upon, really under any circumstances. And so at this point, the United Nations has said that between 1 and 2 million people are trafficked every year around the world. Well, a million people is a fairly wide band of uncertainty. And so if we don't have statistics for modern-day global trafficking, we certainly don't have proper statistics for trafficking that occurred in the last century or even the beginning of this century. So it's very problematic to guess. But I think what we can say is that slavery and various forms of forced labor have been around for thousands of years. And women have certainly been forced into prostitution and held in debt bondage for hundreds of years. So the documentation has been very spotty. Human Rights Watch is working to improve the documentation, by and large by interviewing victims to find out what their experiences are. But there really isn't a very good historical oversight or historical perspective on this.
What are the conditions that make trafficking in women possible?
I'd say the first is discrimination against women. Women who face enormous levels of discrimination in education, in healthcare, in employment, really have very limited options in their own countries. And because of that, many of them are willing to take the enormous risk of migrating. Now, most of the women that I've interviewed around the world who've been trafficked migrated voluntarily. Some small percentage were kidnapped, but by and large, many of these women migrated voluntarily. Many of the women that I've interviewed had children, and their entire purpose for migrating was to send money home to their children because their children didn't have food and their children didn't have money to go to school. And so these women were attempting to find work. That's the second issue. The first is discrimination. The second, frankly, is poverty. Women need to move. Women need to migrate in order to find employment when their own economies are in complete disarray and in complete disintegration. And so many of the women trafficked, for example, now into Greece and Bosnia and Herzegovina come from Moldova. And Moldova is a place where the economy has simply disintegrated since the fall of the Soviet Union. And many of these girls only have ninth grade educations because their families can't afford to send them to school after the ninth grade. It costs too much money. Many of these people don't have telephones. This is the middle of Europe, and they don't have phones. They don't have access to good medical care. And for many, migration seems like the only option.
Are these pretty much the same conditions that made or that encouraged trafficking women, say, in 1895 or 1921, we were discussing the problem then?
Yes, actually, a colleague of mine here at work gave me a book on white slavery several weeks ago. And it seems very similar that traffickers preyed upon women who were vulnerable because of their poverty, because of their need to earn money. Traffickers made outlandish promises, as they do now, that women would have jobs abroad and be able to send money home to their families. And ultimately, traffickers then, as now, tricked women and instead sold them into this modern form of slavery, held them in debt bondage, and forced them to pay back debts, debts that often became artificially inflated with bogus fines and so-called interest payments.
What might the international community do, or what might it undertake in order to resolve this problem?
The international community needs to take trafficking very seriously because it's an international human rights violation that crosses borders and exists within states as well. If states really want to fight trafficking, they will institute victim protection because the only way that you can prosecute traffickers, the only way that you can stop trafficking is by protecting the victims, giving them victim services, respecting their human rights, and particularly putting them in witness protection programs. The problem that victims often have is that, sure, they could testify against the traffickers, but it's like signing their own death warrant, quite frankly. What's more, the traffickers often know where these women come from. They know where their homes are. They know who their families are. And so the women face threats not only to themselves, they face threats to their families at home. And those people they are desperate to protect and don't want to endanger them by testifying against traffickers. The other issue, which is fundamental, is that trafficking absolutely could not flourish without the complicity and corruption of state officials. So we have women who don't want to testify against traffickers because some of those traffickers are policemen, because some of their clients are policemen who come in for freebies in order to protect the brothel. They don't want to testify because they know that people high up in governments are involved in forging documents and creating false passports. Testifying is a risky proposition for these women. So states need to take very serious measures, and some have. Italy has. Germany has, the Netherlands to some extent has, Belgium to some extent has. States need to take very serious measures to provide protection and temporary residence to victims who have had their human rights violated and for those few who actually do decide to testify and bring charges against traffickers.
Ms. Vandenberg, I really wish we had more time. This has really been fascinating. I thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
You have been listening to Ms. Martina Vandenberg, a researcher for Human Rights Watch's Women's Rights Division. Those of you wishing more information on this or any number of other human rights issues are invited to visit the Human Rights Watch's website at hrw.org.
For nearly a century now, film has been one of the most influential mediums on American thought, culture, values, and even behavior. As a result, institutions of higher learning quickly identified it as something that had to be studied carefully. Peter DeCherney, professor of film and media studies at Johns Hopkins University, explores the history of film education and some of the issues it encountered along the way.
Almost with film's first commercial success, enthusiasts saw in it a potential institution of mass education. Thomas Edison and D.W. Griffith, among many others, rhapsodized about the cinema as a people's university, capable of presenting objective knowledge in an all-inclusive venue. During the 1910s and 1920s, this idea of film as a medium of universal appeal and comprehensibility was invoked by reformers, who thought film could Americanize immigrants or replace the tavern as a social meeting place. Leaders in the film industry also embraced the idea of film as a mass educator, because they knew that perceived educational value would make the cinema appealing to a broader segment of middle-class America. The same goals of acculturation and commercial expansion, however, also led to efforts to control the mass influence of film by bringing it into the fold of established educational institutions and traditions. One of the first efforts to teach film as a university subject, for example, occurred as early as 1915, when Columbia University teamed up with two film producers, Jesse Lasky and Adolph Zucker, to offer screenwriting classes in its adult education school. The alliance between higher education and Hollywood was premised on a mutual investment in screenwriting. For the emergent movie moguls, the Columbia courses provided a training mill for a new, professionalized breed of screenwriter. As the Hollywood studio system was taking hold, scripts became vital tools for studios, coping with the unwieldy process of making longer and more complex films. A new, highly detailed script style, called the continuity script, allowed producers to have centralized control over the production process, just as an architect might have over a building. For the university, the screenwriting courses fit neatly within the new mission of its adult education school. Columbia's adult education divisions grew rapidly after the First World War to accommodate the children of New York's immigrants, who were being displaced from the university proper through selective admission standards. The film courses followed the British model of offering civic and moral education beyond university walls, a model that became known as general education. One of the ideals of the university, Columbia film instructor Francis Taylor Patterson explained, is to bring general knowledge within the reach of the many rather than special knowledge to the few. How-to screenwriting courses quickly expanded to encompass film history, film appreciation, and what we might call film literacy. Students learned to read the mass art of film. Just as in Columbia's Great Books curriculum, students would learn to read the Western literary canon. In 1938, the new Museum of Modern Art Film Library took over Columbia's film program. Curator Iris Barry redesigned the curriculum, replacing the moral education of urban immigrants with a program intended to inculcate technical and aesthetic expertise in academics and community leaders. In this way, many of the factors that have continued to make film at once desirable and awkward for universities, its popular appeal, its promise of making academic work relevant beyond specialized circles, and its potential to attract corporate involvement in higher education, also drove and plagued earlier attempts to invent film education.
You've been listening to Peter DeCherney, professor of film and media studies at Johns Hopkins University. And for our site of the week, we've selected a museum where you can learn more about the history of film. And here to tell you about it is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
When you think of film, the name Eastman Kodak is one of the biggest names associated with film, whether it is still photography or motion pictures. The George Eastman House, an International Museum of Photography and Film, located on historic East Avenue in Rochester, is the urban estate of George Eastman, the founder of Eastman Kodak. The museum, which opened in 1949, displays the arts, technology, and impact of photography in motion pictures over 150 years, as well as interprets the life of Mr. Eastman. The motion picture collection was founded in 1947, making it one of the oldest film archives in the United States, including an unsurpassed collection of silent films. It is now considered to be among the top cinematic collections worldwide. The collection contains film titles encompassing features, shorts, documentaries, newsreels, and related amateur and video productions produced between 1894 and the present. There's enough here to keep any film buff busy, and events offered throughout the year have a little something for everyone, from film festivals to still photography lectures.
Finally, turning to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions, we alert you to interesting television programs soon to air on the History Channel and PBS. On June 11th, grab a beer and turn on the History Channel for Breweries, a history of the production of beer in America from the Pilgrims to the present. Brewing was one of the earliest commercial ventures in America, and it has remained one of the most successful. And on PBS on June 23rd and 30th, look for Red Gold, the epic story of Blood, a four-part series that explores Blood's integral role in world history. The series is based on Douglas Starr's critically acclaimed book, Blood, an Epic History of Medicine and Commerce. Be sure to check your local listings for the exact showtimes of these History Channel and PBS programs. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show. We invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Talking History is a production of Creighton University and the Organization of American Historians. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.